Okay, welcome to the Visions of a Better World podcast once again. I am Max Talbari, and today Astrid Aminoff and from University of Helsinki, and that is Christian Klokkars, Sade Hormio and Matthias Lehtinen. So thank you all for being here, and can you please shortly introduce yourselves, and then Astrid can start the discussion.
Okay, I'm Christian Klokkars. I work as a senior university lecturer in practical philosophy. Mostly I'm interested in areas connected to political philosophy and also, yes, global issues related to sort of contemporary discourse in political philosophy and global political theory, these kind of issues.
My name is Sade Hormio, and I'm an academy research fellow here at Practical Philosophy, the University of Helsinki, and I study collective responsibility, and I'm especially interested in the relationship of individual and collective responsibility, or kind of shared responsibility we have of these big major problems in our day, like climate change or misinformation or any of these things. And yeah, so I'm just interested in that connection.
And my name is Matthias Lehtinen. I'm a postdoctoral researcher here at the Practical Philosophy Department. My research is mainly concerned with contemporary political theory and philosophy, questions relating to democracy, political imagination, and polarization. Right now I'm working on a research project called Political Imagination and the Crisis of Political Rationality, where I look at the kind of polarization of political rationality in democratic societies.
Okay, thank you so much. Firstly, thank you everyone for being here, and I apologize for taking a moment to get started, but everything's working now. I think when we were discussing with Max and then also a little bit with you guys over email the background for this episode, then one of the things we wanted to talk about is this idea of something that's come up actually in our previous panels. Then the conclusion has been this frustration with this type of what they called rhetorical moralism, where we say, for example, in the case of human rights, that we have these human rights agreements, but then they don't work in practice because we have our closest allies, our Saudi Arabia, etc., or China, and we still do trade. But even though we demand these types of values that from some others, but then the double standard of them that we don't demand them of our closest allies. So that's something that has been on our mind quite a lot, I think, in discussions. And that's why I came up with this question that I wanted to ask you guys to begin with, is this idea of universal values. So firstly, what are universal values? And secondly, do they exist? And I would hope that Christian could begin.
Okay, yes, I can begin. Yes, it's really, when you talk about things like universal values and also human rights, of course, it's important that you reflect on what you actually mean and might mean by these things. So sometimes, I mean, the notion of universal value gives some sort of kind of aura that it's something that is independent and outside, external, and you can found the foundations in the world for it. While usually, actually, of course, by universal values, we mean something that is common in some sense to all. And the question is, are there such things that we can say, claim are common to all? Do they exist? Well, always it's a first question of what we say, what kind of conclusions and justifications we can put forward. So, but I will put that in a schematic way. You can do these exist. Well, what are we thinking about? We can, of course, think that there are some areas of life that are common to all human beings and maybe common to all living beings, and that from out of these experiences and conditions there arises some values. For example, that nobody wants to experience. But most people don't want to experience pain, especially not from other people. Mm. So that's kind of a ground we don't want. Nobody likes that. Or maybe that all human beings have sort of like freedom to some extent, to have some kind of freedom. Then you could say sort of it comes from experience. But then it becomes very soon complicated, because when we think about this, making a list like this, it's usually very short.
Mm.
And we can say sort of pain is no good, some kind of freedom. But after that, we there maybe are not things that are common to all human beings. That becomes very complicated. And then the second complication is that, okay, what do we mean by pain? What do we mean by freedom? It's easy to understand that you don't want to experience pain from other people. That is sort of in the physical sense, but of course there's other areas of pain. Mm. If you are teased at school, you feel pain. That's pain. So what do we actually mean by this? And freedom, of course, becomes even more complicated. So you always need to then begin to interpret what are the things that are meant. So that's a difficulty with this this aspect. But on the other hand, I would say, I mean, this kind of concepts, terms, equality, democracy, freedom, and others, they are also part of our everyday life. And in all kind of, most cultures in the world have sort of, they exist in these cultures where people have some kind of intuitive grasp of what they are all about. And in that sense, we can see that it's a common thing. I mean, whatever culture, I would say, people have some kind of conception of freedom. So they know something, they have something to go back to. So in that sense, it's a kind of, many of these common things, and they're common partly in the sense that we have this concept that everybody sort of understands roughly what they're about. We can't define them, we can't specify backs, but yeah, so that there you have some kind of commonness. But it doesn't, in the sense, create a foundation for claiming something as a universal value. And the way you do that, you need to sort of define, specify, what do you mean? But there's this kind of background thing in experience or in different cultures. So that's one way of route of thinking about them. Another route of thinking about them is that what is common in philosophy is that you view all claims of values in terms as sort of recent stated things. That means whatever you say that equality is good for all, you need to specify and be able to tell everyone why this is so. So you justify this. And if everyone agrees on the justification, yes, of course, and nobody is against, everybody feels, yes, that's good, of course, it's a good thing, then you have a kind of other kind of common ground. But of course, you'll never reach sort of bedrock foundation. It will always be up to, for example, how we understand, how should we understand equality? That's a controversial issue. But somehow I think that we have this, and that this is why in rhetorical moralism they are sort of can be effective. If you say that you use force in the name of human rights, it's partly because everybody understands what is meant by human rights.
Mm.
So it has cast a hand that can be effective because people know what human rights are. So that's why rhetorical moralism in a way dependent on this that we understand what they mean. Rhetorical moralism, this kind is also always extremely risky because exactly for the same reason. You say you want to invade this country for humanitarian reasons. Okay, you understand. But then, as you said, there's humanitarianism and human rights is a wide thing that is sort of all over the world, all over the place, and can be interpreted and understood in different ways. So it's very risky things also. But this is the kind of maybe you want to.
Yeah, sure. I was thinking maybe what I find quite useful is thinking of it in terms of like thick and thin concept. So there are certain things, you know, that we share as human beings, right? Like our existence and as species. There's certain things like that humans are just more prone everywhere. Like we have to have certain sense of equality and things like that Christian said, you know, most of us, it is just, you know, these rare cases where you want to have pain. Almost nobody wants to have that, especially inflicted by others. So so there's certain things that kind of connects us as species and gives rise to our kind of shared values in a sense. And you could say that they are universal, but that's in a very kind of thin concept sense. Like what is equality, for example? What is justice and other things? And then it's the thick concepts, which are then in that particular time and space, in that particular culture, how these values are actually then transferred to the kind of social norms and that things that are actually legislation and other things that are happening in that society, what kind of form they take. So you can have that this kind of top level, thin level agreement on things, where you can then have lots of disagreements on the thick level, how they're actually applied. And I think another thing also to keep in mind is that you can have these values, but how well are they actually realized? That's a different question. And there's a lot of things there that are hindering the realization of the value. So you can also have, and what does a nation believe, right? You know, is that the government of the nation, the people who are in charge of the nation at the moment, or the general values in that nation? So I think you can say in a lot of cases that this nation, for example, has human rights as part of their values, but it doesn't necessarily show in the politics they're doing. And there's lots of reasons. There can be huge inequalities in power, who's actually in charge. Maybe it's an authoritative, you know, state, or maybe it's a democratic state that doesn't work that well at all, you know. So so you can have these values in society, but they can kind of get twisted on the way. And we have a lot of these examples also where people, even in like democratic, well-off countries where we have a lot of say and we don't have to worry that we get thrown in jail, we're, for example, demonstrating against the policies of our democratic elected leaders and being very frustrated, for example, that they don't take action. But then who is it to say, like, what is the... What are the values that are reflected in the policies of that country? So an example would be like the way United Kingdom went into, like Britain went into the whole Iraq invasion back after 9/11, like with Tony Blair. There was humongous demonstrations all around the streets of Britain. Like the public opinion was completely against that, but still British soldiers went there. So what kind of values are then shown and whose values are shown in that kind of thing? Like, what is the country? What was the, who was the one who was actually sending the troops there? So I think it's very complex when we're talking at this level of these big collective things like states, like what is actually being reflected. So that's why it's almost inevitable that you'll see this tension there. It still doesn't, in my opinion, eradicate that those values are there. It's just they're being contested and then they're being like put into different uses by different people, have different versions of them and stuff. But it doesn't mean that there's nothing there kind of shared behind the whole thing.
Can I also comment before Matthias continue? But in one of the panel discussions, Mario Ma brought up this thing about human rights, that we have human rights that the UN is, as it's a very kind of Western conception of human rights, but then he also brought up how these Islamic countries have their own version of human rights from 1990, but then from,
or African Charter of Human Rights.
Yeah, they have different ones, but then they have a very different idea than of gender rights and rights of women, etc. So then, and so there's maybe something shared, but then they don't apply in the same way. But that said, then is the idea that this UN's Convention of Human Rights is the dominant conception of human rights at the moment, or these types of values then that have been used to jump in whoever feels most strongly about
it. Of course, the UN Declaration is kind of the largest one, so it's dominant, but these other ones are equally important. And I think this goes back to what Sade was saying about thick and thin, that, I mean, the UN Declaration at its basis, it could only succeed by being very, very thin.
Mm.
But it's also very, very sort of very clearly stated, but thin.
Yeah.
So you could have that. But you always have to have this negotiation or transfer between the thin to become thick, to become real actions. And then you always have this open space that people can understand these differently. But the point is still that there's continuous connection between the thick and the thin. So when you go to a thick and try to define sort of how we want to see equality, you can never sort of finalize that, because you always have a thin one in the background also, that through which you can criticize that thick one. So it's an open space. there.
And I think it's also, yeah, of course, the UN one is the most widely adopted at the moment, the most influential, you could easily say that. But you have to think of also, like, it's like a, in a certain sense, also a historical document born out of the horrors of the Second World War. How can we prevent this happening again? And it's also, in a certain sense, live document, right? You know, because there are then these also different UN actions, you know, that are based on human rights courts and there, and it's constantly being negotiated and renegotiated. Where does it actually apply in these real life cases and things? Mm. So it's not like it was something that was decided and then it just stays there, right? So there is that thing, but I think there's some genuine like cultural difference as well in like in the African human rights things that are, or like in Asia, there's this idea of also seeing the rights more as the rights of a community rather than the individuals. So the you can see like the influence there of who was drafting the UN declaration, that it's a very individualistic, for example. So yeah, so there are some genuine like differences there as well, but of course there's a lot of these very basic things that these things have in right, but then they can be twisty things that you say that, well, certain people don't have these rights in certain applications, which, and then you have to think like, well, is it because we don't actually share the values, or there's something kind of goes wrong in the application, that there's something, for example, twisting the conversation in that society, for example, in that context, usually power relation.
Yeah, I could circle back to the question about universal rights. Very good comments, both of you. And Christian, so I was actually reading up on Kofi Annan's speech about him, the former UN General Secretary. He had a speech, very famous speech from 2003 about universal values, where he tried to define what they are about. And he said that, okay, he knows there are some universal values: peace, freedom, social progress, equal rights, human dignity. And what is interesting about this Annan speech is that he went on arguing that the, and I quote from his speech, that the validity of universal values does not depend on their being universally obeyed or applied, which is a very interesting kind of take on what universal values are about, because you could take this kind of philosophical distinction here, and you could say that what Annan is that he is a kind of moral realist. So he thinks that, okay, we have some universally true valuable things, such as peace, which then means that, okay, their validity is always kind of given, and it doesn't hinge on what people are actually doing, right? So that would be the kind of realist, moral realist kind of take on universal values. And on the other hand, you can take some kind of social constructivist take on universal values and say that, okay, universal values are those values which people at a certain time adapt, and kind of, if there are resonances or kind of equalities between the ways people perceive of what is important and good or bad, then you have some kind of universal values, right? But these are two very different kind of perspectives, I think. So what Kofi Annan is saying is that, okay, we have something is really actually good, that's a universal good, peace, or then we look at how people actually perceive good or bad and look for kind of equivalences between people's value systems. So then the question about your second question, right? Are there universal values? That becomes a very different answer if you're a moral realist and you try to say, defend some kind of universal values in this sense, that there are some objectively true universal values, or then you can, of course, do as Christian was proposing, that, okay, we can look at some kind of maybe even extra social source for these universal values, maybe some kind of biological foundation, we don't want pain or so on. But that would of course be one way of justifying. But okay, I'm a political philosopher, so I usually lean towards the social constructivist accounts and like to think about how people kind of actually perceive good or bad and what kind of resonances might be found. Of course, hugely complicated question. And as Sade was saying, I mean, also we're going to have a huge kind of differences in shared values when we look at different kind of institutional settings and levels of societies and actors and so on. So, I mean, when we're trying to, even if we are these kind of social constructivist thinkers, when we try to figure out what then are these shared values, we're going to get a lot of complexity when we go into the kind of thick of it, into the kind of social fabric with all its different kind of inequalities and so on. But one thing which wasn't maybe still mentioned, which I would maybe like to point out, is that also when we're discussing universal values, it's important to ask kind of maybe critical question about universality. So what do we mean with universality? And I'm thinking here, of course, about these kind of challenges that feminist and post-colonial thinkers have raised regarding the question of universality. And of course, a lot of post-colonial feminist thinkers ask, like, who's universality? That what do we mean by who gets to define what kind of power relations are involved in thinking about there being some kind of more comprehensive value systems. I mean, the post-colonial kind of critique of universal values in this sense has of course been that which is kind of encoded into the, for example, UN Charter of Human Rights and so on, has been kind of values inherent to maybe European colonial project of universalizing a certain kind of form of life, maybe European form of life in this sense. So I think that's also important to be mindful of these power relations, which have to do with universalization, that is claiming something to be kind of universal to us all, or that there is a moment of power. If we borrow, for example, this Antonio Gramsci, this Marxist philosopher, he uses this concept of hegemony to denote precisely this moment of power when someone coming from some location of the social field, group of people, say that, okay, this is now universal, what we are thinking. These particular people formulate the kind of idea of what is universal, and that is kind of for Gramsci, what is hegemony? It is universalizing something that is not actually universal. So I also like to think about this kind of line of critique, or at least keep it in mind when kind of thinking about these universal questions.
Yeah, that's, and I would like to add also the level of institutions here. You started with Kofi Annan, and that's a good example. I mean, you could see the UN Declaration as a real achievement, and as I emphasized, it's an ongoing process. It's not something that happened in the 40s and stopped. It's going on all the time. It's that's why you talk about the UN system as a process still going on. And that was through the establishment of an institution, agreement, and declarations. And of course, when you manage to establish an institution, you can begin that work of defining, for example, as Kofi Annan is doing, defining what we mean then by universal values. And you have as long as the institution is there, you have the authority, and the authority might grow. And we take you, and it's of course it's a large institution. But then, as you said, it's very, very important that we have these kind of other institutions that are sort of a kind of checks and balances of this power. The UN becomes a powerful institution, but it also needs these other institutions, other kinds of declarations through which you can put pressure and checks and balances on this one institution, develop maybe alternative conceptions that somehow throughout the time might become more influential. So I think the institution as such has a role here. It becomes sort of, when you establish an institution and it becomes powerful, it begins to define its own project also. It's not only dependent on the outside, on the nation states, on the big ones. It begins to sort of create its own project. And then it can become powerful in its own. It might be a good power, but it also needs this sort of an outside, other institutions that keeps it in, is able to criticize. So it's really important then that we have these other declarations also, because through that we have this continuous open discourse also.
Just a short comment. Exactly, that's something I've been thinking about a lot as well, with the future of the UN and also these critiques from these post-colonial critiques and then from the so-called Global South, where they are basically, isn't it like a certain countries in the 40s, the winning powers in a sense came together who decided these things, and that's how those have been decided like 60 or how many years ago is it now? And then even if they're fluid and kind of changing all the time, but then are those voices heard? I feel like maybe there's more happening in the UN just on like where they do say that, if I'm just following their Instagram, and they do bring up these different more post-colonial perspectives, I think more. But then it also feels, as we know, they don't have any power to really implement a lot of the things that they're saying at the moment. So do you feel that the UN could have the power to, I'm going to have a bit like looking towards the future a little bit more. Do you think there could be power for it to change in a way that it would become more some type of universal, like for example, peace? You can be a bit utopian.
Yeah, well, I think the UN is as powerful as the states allow it to be, right? Because mm-hmm. it is a thing to coordinate the actions of states it's trying to have a peace function, right? But I think it's wrong to say, I think you're completely right that, yeah, in the starting of the process and, you know, winning states and everything, and then back then we still had lots of countries literally under colonial power, right? So they weren't even members of the United Nations. But so the so-called Global South actually has a voice these days in a lot of the things in UN. So what we're usually thinking is the Security Council. And that's kind of, I would say, quite, in my opinion, dated, the way those voting goes and who holds the power there. And it also shows that it often doesn't really work these days. But that's kind of different than when you're looking at the kind of wider thing. And of course, you know, so you have the general assemblies, you know, where all the nations are represented, right? And everybody gets to have their say. Then you have all these different kinds of, different like UNDP or FAO or all these other ones. They can be a lot of power. In the kind of Global South, within those debates and those discourses and things. It's just what gets in the very kind of, the Security Council kind of overshadows all of that, how sophisticated some of these debates are at the UN level. And I think the problem is more like that there is so many of different kind of views, and that is like a genuinely very pluralistic debate in many of these different parts of the massive UN infrastructure, is that some of these conversations and some of these reports and other things, they're kind of uncomfortable to some of the powerful players, and some of the things that UN tries to push for are kind of uncomfortable truths or kind of go too far from the way things are presently, right? And then it's more like a case of powerful players blocking the process and the progress where UN is going anyway, right? So it's more like allowing that to happen, but that has to happen. The powerful states have to like allow, give more power to the UN thing, give respect to that thing as well, and give respect to certain. There's this tendency to also that you certain states like support, and I think maybe all the states kind of do this, they support you and when it kind of works in their favor, and then when it just says something they don't want to hear, then it's like, well, actually, no, that's nonsense, you know, because there's just, we shouldn't forget that there's so many parts of it, right? And they're the ones that are making, like, you know, the reporting stuff. They're like all kinds of different specialist organizations and everything. There's just tons of stuff happening. So I don't know. Maybe I am being generally too optimistic, but I think there's a lot of potential there. I don't think we haven't gotten it to work yet, you know. But then again, you know, in the kind of in the general like long term thing, it's generally quite a new thing still, United Nations. So yeah, I think we could get it to work much better. And there's certain things that it is already, it has worked in a very, very great way. So we should also give it credit. But yeah, definitely has a lot of challenges, but it's kind of like political will all around the world that is needed there to make it better.
Yes, and as a sort of commentary to that, power, usually with power, we understand all of the possibility to make decisions and sign things, and now we do like this, and we have this project, and we do it. But actually, of course, in the world, in the political sense, at least two different kinds of power. You have this power to decide, perhaps, and the nation states have more power than the UN to decide on political matters. But then nothing of this can work without all of the power of, let's say, large civil society in a way, or the power of the kind of things that people say about how the world should be like. And the UN, of course, have a big role in just stating this. And as I said, as an institution, it is sort of dependent on the nation state, but it also has its own internal project, so it can become radical.
Yeah.
And present radical things, radical thoughts. We need to go this, we need to agree on these climate-related issues, we must do that. Yeah. And just putting forward these things in a way that people sense that, okay, here is someone who's saying something that we should follow, although the politicians are not going to decide it. So you have this other aspect of power, the power of a kind of symbolic thing that you put forward values, say we need to do these kind of things, we can't decide on it, but you need to do it. And people understand it. So this is, this is also important. So it's a kind of debate that should the UN be developed into a system where it has more power to decide and for execution, yeah. Or should it stay as this kind of having this influential role, coming along, saying things, stop, you should stop this war now, you should do this about climate change, and its power should sort of be only that, and then the power decision should stay with Nations. So you have
this. I think that's a good point, and I think it depends on the different like functions of United Nations. You know, there's certain things where it should have more power to say, like, you know, let's stop a war in certain cases, right? And then there's other things where it definitely should not have a say in, for example, determining like maybe economic policy for a certain country or things like that, you know, that it wouldn't. I see it more as a kind of that it should be like global facilitator of debates. It's like facilitates these debates, genuine like global debates about values, about what should be doing about a certain thing. Sometimes it can be very I'd like to see that the UN process would have more power in terms of, for example, climate change, right? That there's certain things that it can do so well. It's a global problem, and we have this science, you know, that's being very, very strongly behind this action, and maybe there's certain things that it should have then more power to work on specific problems, right? To get them fixed, you know? But then in terms of, I think it's like its strength that is this kind of facilitator of global debate, right? Because there's always like power tends to corrupt. So it's very good to have different kinds of players from all around the world having their own say in things, different kinds of global voices, you know? There's always like some point that even the best experts on an issue or something, they haven't thought. And then you can really have this genuine process of where you're trying to come up with this joint good, or maybe these kind of visions that you were saying, like, and UN does involve, for example, civil society actors, NGOs, you know, also like they're trying to increasingly get like corporations in many of their processes and stuff. So it is true, as Christian said, it's not just states, right? It's trying to facilitate lots of different actors in society globally. But yeah, I think that kind of global facilitator role is very important, and I think that's valuable. And they shouldn't be the global boss, you know? They should be like the global kind of forum for us to decide how to have together.
I think this leads actually quite well into this question then of polarization, which Matthias, you just said you have a perspective on, because then the UN how can it succeed if we don't have a consensus on the things that the UN is doing? Like, for example, I feel sometimes it feels like this to me. I think this is a lot more post-Trump time, that you feel like you're existing in a completely different reality than someone else's, even though you're in the same country. Like, I've grown up in Finland and I kind of always thought that we shared pretty much the same values, but then I noticed that things that I take as given, and usually they are things like human rights and these things, then other people have very different opinions and they kind of start to erode. And that's what I feel is happening a lot in Europe at the moment with the upcoming elections and this kind of polarization where we can't have a consensus on climate policies and human rights, lots of these things. So somehow, how can the UN succeed in this type of polarized world? Is that a very simple question?
Very good question.
Also very hard. Very hard question. I mean, the first thing you can think about is, do we need consensus in order to act? I mean, we don't have consensus about most things in nation states or in local kind of municipalities or whatever, and a lot of things get done all the time. So, I mean, and when we talk or think about the UN as a kind of global actor, if it is a global actor at all, but then of course we should, if we think that, okay, we have a global actor, is the UN, and we need consensus for it to function, then that would be a very strenuous and harsh kind of thing to do, to get a global consensus on some like important matters such as climate political interventions or whatever. So I don't think that's a good way to go, to think about like trying to achieve full consensus on things. But that's maybe not what you were saying. You were also talking about this kind of senses of differing realities or living in different worlds. So I mean, it's also good to think about what we're meaning by polarization, right? That some kind of polarization is always good for democracies, I think, and for all kind of human societies, because polarization means also that we have different ways of approaching reality, which is, I mean, for a pluralist democratic society, something which is very central. Of course, we have bad kinds of polarization. And we can look at this, for example, by this distinction between so-called ideological and affective polarization. Ideological polarization maybe means more that you were talking about, that there's an increasing rift between the way people kind of understand what's meaningful, significant in the social world, and kind of what kind of goals people set up for politics and so on. Then we have affective polarization, which is then this kind of animosity between camps. So at least theoretically speaking, we can have this kind of ideological polarization without affective polarization. We can have this kind of thought that, okay, we think in different senses, but we don't feel animosity, we can maybe work together and so on. So, I mean, yes, we can have some kind of difference without it being bad, or even polarization, I would say. Then, of course, if this polarization is about some kind of very foundational issues for democracies, for example, that's a problem. So if one camp in the kind of polarizing camps doesn't trust or believe that their democracy is a good way to go about, then that's a different kind of issue than this kind of standard polarization, that's kind of extremization of some political actors in society.
Yeah, I think it's that respect part that you were saying, that you know, that you need in like a democratic decision making, you need compromises, right? You can agree to disagree on certain issues, but you agree to move on, for example, on that thing. But you can have that respect to the other people's views, that you don't have to agree with them, but you respect we are different, and then we're still working together on something. And then there's that the other side that Matias was saying, where it's like just like you're just wrong, and we're not going to work together with you on anything, and let's just like burn the whole house down kind of thing. And that's very, very, very bad for democracy.
Yes, and I think that this this letter is it's quite a new thing, really, very very recent, and we all have a difficult to understand it. What's why is this now. I mean, it's been on for 10 years. If you go back 20, 25 years, you had also polarization, pluralism, you had radical views from the right and left, but nobody was really concerned because they were just speaking and there was some violence here and there, but it wasn't sort of foundational. But now we have sort of something newer that is more foundational. But it's very difficult to explain and understand it at the moment. And we don't know how long this will go on. Will it go on for the next 50 years or end in 2 years?
Yeah.
And going back once more to the UN example, does UN need a consensus? That's again, I mean, there's a strength of an institution. You found an institution and then it has its basic charter.
Mm-hmm.
We work on these principles. So the institution is there and it has its principles and you can't go against those. So then it's a question, as long as the institution stays on, it has this foundation. But of course, we could imagine in 10 years, if half of the big countries of the world will sort of resign from the UN, we will have it will sort of crumble. But we don't know if that, at the moment, it still stays. Everyone wants to be a member still. And that means that that institution has sort of a kind of foundation. It has its values. You can't be against those values. So it's they sort of, and it can work from out of that. But then, yes, what will happen in the future is a different thing. So, but it's, so many cases, polarization is just an ordinary thing. It's part of way of life. It depends on the fact that we live in different conditions, different societies, different material conditions, and so on. And we think differently because we are in different positions in different societies. So that then it's natural in a way, in that sense, that it becomes polarized. But what is going on this affective level of animosity? I can't foresee the future. We can't, but it's worrying. Yes.
I would maybe link it also to this kind of third form of polarization, which might also be called material polarization or inequality. Yes, of course, I mean, we are different people. Society is a complex, there are different positions. People come from different worlds, in this sense, different backgrounds and different contexts. So there is always difference, there's always plurality. But then this kind of growing inequality, which we are seeing across the Western world, at least, everywhere, I think that could all and has been connected by kind of empirical researchers to growing ideological polarization. So when we have one group of people who live in such radical kind of difference from another group of people in terms of material resources, in terms of access to power, for example, and these kind of things, then you, of course, there comes these feelings of resentment and maybe even hostility and animosity, but I don't think this is at all the whole kind of picture. But I think also this kind of dimension of inequality is important to kind of factor in when we think about where these kind of affective dynamics are coming from. That if we have a growing kind of rift between rich and poor, for example, the dispossessed and those who have more, then I mean there is going to be strong feelings.
I'm sure that's a contributor, and that's the thing with these kind of very big macro level trends, right? There's usually not one thing that's driving it. There's a confluence of things, and the kind of intra country inequality has been rising humongously in the past decades. You know, like people, there's actually been less inequality between countries, but within countries globally, like, you know, the richer are getting richer. And there's this whole category of these really, really super rich people who can be found all around the world, you know, and then that kind of thing, as you said, you know, that like it of course it like and grow things like resentment. And then there's of course like a lot of people argue that also because you were talking about how there's these different realities that you're living in your own kind of social bubble and thing. You know, there's been a lot of talk, of course, about like how algorithms and other things can be feeding into this thing, that if you like certain kind of thing, then the algorithm starts showing you more of that kind of content. And it's always very effective content because that's the one that gets most reactions and likes and other things. So then the whole thing gets this kind of, that it's almost like your buttons are being pressed all the time. And we shouldn't also forget that we went through a global pandemic you know, that has left lots of scars. We almost like don't really, everybody's still kind of sick of the pandemic that we don't really want to talk about it. But that's also, and depending, like, of course, in the country and what kind of measures were in place. But there's also a lot of problem with, like, you know, for example, young people now, like, with their mental health problems and when you've been, like, isolating for a long time. And I think all of that is kind of, there's a lot of contributors to the general feeling of unease.
A short comment. I recently wrote a blog post about this Dutch researcher. I read his book. I recommend it to everyone who's interested in algorithms. Ico Mele. He wrote a book about the far right and algorithms and this concept of metapolitics, which is, I think it's a kind of, it's kind of from the 60s. It started as a reaction towards after the Second World War. Those far right groups kind of went underground and then they had publications and then they resurfaced in this type of meme culture right after 9/11. And then they started to, like, they somehow learned how to circulate their ideas very well in these memes as, like, comical things, and then they became viral. And then after that, it seems research has shown that these far-right groups or far-right lean groups kind of have a bit of the upper hand on these online spaces. So, for example, with Trump, and then even in our previous presidential election, there was some research that found that YouTube recommended more of the far, well, I wouldn't say far right, but right leaning candidates' content on YouTube. So that, and that, like, if your reality comes from what you see online, then you can fall into this very easily, that then it's like your reality just becomes what you see on your computer screen. But I'll try and frame this in two questions. So if we have, for example, that people go into their own bubbles like that, then how do we have truths when it comes to, for example, climate change, science? With the pandemic, we saw there was a big polarization with the vaccines of who would take the vaccine and who wouldn't take the vaccine. And then there we also saw this power problem of how states can't actually force anyone to take a vaccine. And then, I don't know, with these climate things, how can we enforce? So we could do, like, the EU came up with this new law, these caps, which is a very, I have had many conversations. I don't know if you have encountered these political, this is a big, in some places it's a very contested issue. And if you make a mistake of saying, like, oh, that's a nice thing, you might end up in a big rabbit hole. But these type of ideas of, like, If people are become polarized in this effective way, and they end up in these bubbles, then how do we have some truth? For example, with climate change, is it laws that have to be established on an international level, or how are they enforced? Many thoughts, and you guys can kind of come up with
answers. Yeah, very good point. And as a kind of addition to this polarization, or explaining polarization, of course, this is what you said, discursive aspect that nowadays you can get influenced through the internet and by people all over the world very easily. You can find sort of ways, sites where you are, you can get your own thinking into a certain form, and then you sort of become a part of that bubble or group, and it's very easy, much easier to do that than it's a very global phenomenon, of course, that you and that has, I think, has been a part of this polarization, that it's so easy. It has become a global phenomenon and it's all there now. It's so easy to find. And it has this affective component also very strongly present, it's easier to get influenced in something that affects you. So that's important. So then yes, well, how the truth. you can of course continue fighting in the usual way that you present sort of this is lies and this is the truth. Then you might lose sort of the affective game, but because that's not effective. Telling the truth is not sort of that is very effective. But I guess that is one still a very essential, because I see some risks in the second one. I mean, legislation that you would go that way, because that's power politics, that from above, that you begin to legislate things. And that's easily transformed. There's no other possibility, so let's legislate. This is forbidden and so on.
Yeah.
But then you are moving in a sort of more totalitarian direction. The more you have that kind of politics.
It's quite dangerous when it comes to like what are you allowed to say if that's legislated, because then you can easily, as Christian said, you can have then what if, for example, the politics in your country change, that the leaders like come up with these laws with good intentions, and then you have a totally different type of leader in 10 years' time, they can exploit them. You know, I think it's very important people get to voice their opinions, right? But then there's a different, totally different thing when it comes to, well, what is the truth? I don't think the truth goes away anywhere. You know, there is like, you know, climate science and climate change is not like an opinion. It's based on science, you know, and it's based on very, very highly corroborated science, right? There's a humongous consensus. It's something between 97% to 99% on the basic facts of climate change. Then, of course, there's a lot of things we don't still know. And a lot of the things we don't know is based on things that we don't actually know what's going to happen. So we have these different projections that if the global average temperature is going to rise to 1.5 or 2 or 3 or 4 degrees or whatever, what's going to happen. But of course, those are the kind of things we can't predict because we don't know yet what kind of actions we are going to take or we don't take at the moment. And then there's certain, like, we don't know everything about, like, the carbon cycle and the oceans and other things like that. But climate science has been incredibly successful in like, telling us what are the basic mechanisms and what is happening and what was written in the 90s has actually taken place already, that this is going to happen without inadequate action and stuff. And these are the kind of changes we're going to start seeing around the time that we are now living. You know, so the science, it doesn't, you know, a science has its own like processes, like peer review and other things that are really like at the core of science. And that's, it's a very, like science is very robust the way we're doing it, right? So it doesn't take away the truth of the science if people don't believe it. So those are like different issues. Then if you're talking about the truth of like consensus, of are people taking it seriously enough? Yeah, then that's a different issue. It doesn't take away the truth of the actual science, right? And you can't you can spin certain things in your bubble, but certain things are still going to happen. For example, in the real world, you're gonna have much more extreme weather events. You know, you can't like kind of bubble those away, and that's just going to increase and increase as we go along. So I mean, there's only a certain limit that you can stretch the reality, right? But in terms of then how would you go best about like trying to get others to see it? And I think most people actually believe, like, you know, it depends on from country to another, but there's a lot of, like, one of the countries with the highest number of skeptics, it's United States. But even there, it's mostly kind of like sitting on the fence kind of skeptics. There's very little of this kind of very hardcore ideological denialists who are saying that this is not true. It's more like, well, it seems complex and I don't know, and some people are saying other things. And we should also keep in mind that it hasn't just happened to come about when it comes to, for example, climate change. It hasn't been some byproduct of algorithms or something. This has been very, very consciously manufactured, this doubt that we see, for example, in America, United States, because like it was concentrated lobbying efforts by the fossil fuel industry. They started it, so their own scientists, when the climate science was emerging in the like late 60s and 70s and 80s. So climate, like fossil fuel companies had their own scientists look at the same data that was looked at. Then this was before IPCC was put together. And they were like, confirmed it. Yes, this is happening. This is like man-made. And we're going to have these effects that are going to start showing at the turn of the century. But if we take action now, you know, there's time and it's much cheaper and blah, blah, blah. But so there's these leaked reports that we keep finding that have been leaked in recent years, showing that the fossil fuel companies were among the first to know about it. And this wasn't a partisan issue to start off with. Like in America, Republicans were just as much on board as the Democrats were. And they were going to, in the 80s, they were going to like get some legislation going. And they were really worried. They put this big high-level committee together where we're looking at these things. And they were natural scientists and they were economists. And then it was the economist message that's saying, like, let's fund more research, you know? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like we're going to ignore what the natural scientists are saying. It's more like, yeah, but we have to, like, watch and wait, like, what are the actual implications of society? And let's, you know, that was the thing. It was delaying technique. And those kind of things, the funding often came, not in that particular report, but it was still, there was a lot lobbying effort behind it from the fossil fuel company. And they actually, and what they started doing, putting their own like experts in the media and everywhere, like trying to nitpick some like evidence and like, I mean, cherry pick and go like, oh, well, there's some like exaggerating the uncertainties they were. And this was a technique that they copied from the tobacco industry. There's a very good book, The Emergence of Doubt, by Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway, where they look at the fact how these kind of lobby groups use the same techniques over and over on different issues, like sugar or cancer and tobacco or climate change. Just the same playbook over and over. And the whole idea was to manufacture doubt. They actually said that something like, doubt is our product, right? So the idea is like that you're just creating this still, this kind of feeling of uncertainty that I'm not sure, let's wait. Like, not that, so you take away the urgency of like the scientific evidence coming, like we need to take action now. And you replace it with this, doubt thing, you know? And that's enough. So you don't have to make people deny the science. You don't have to make people like kind of wholesale reject the truth of the science. You just need to like muddle the waters enough that the action is delayed. And that's what's done with the climate change. So I think it's a very kind of, it's a very different kind of case than a lot of the polarizing issues, which are maybe like we're getting polarized and kind of around different kinds of values and how they play out and stuff. This was like a very concentrated effort and they succeeded in doing, and the whole legislation process was delayed and it was successful. So it's it didn't just come about. That's my point.
Yeah, I think those are really good points. So then I was thinking about this: how can we have a truth in politics? And as Sade was saying, it would maybe be good to operate with a kind of more sophisticated notion of truth and politics here. That, and Sade was saying that scientific truths, they are there. It doesn't matter what we think politically or kind of what the social consensus about things is or so on. The scientific truths stay as they are, in the same way the laws of nature stay as they are. I mean,
I think you were saying that,
there are only certain limits that we can, to certain limits that we can stretch reality. And I think this is a very important point that I would like to kind of maybe emphasize, is that it comes to politics and political kind of the frameworks, ideological, imaginary or otherwise, that we use to support our political thinking. We can have ideologies, we can have political programs which are based on science, hard science, right? But then that science in itself is not a politics, but it has to be taken up, mobilized, maybe in ideological or kind of political form. It has to become part of some project, a concrete political project. So there is always, when we have these kind of things such as climate politics, where we tread the kind of limit between hard science and then the question about what we're going to do with our societies, there's always this kind of moment of translation between what the scientists are saying and what we as social collectives, how we take these facts in and how we weave it into our kind of understanding of how social relations should be set up, what's valuable in society and so on. And that's why I'm a bit skeptical to this kind of question about how to have truth in politics, because the truth, like the natural scientific truth, isn't the politics in itself. It can, of course, tell us what we should do if we don't want to destroy ourselves, but people can act in ways that are not conducive or like true or good for the climate, right? And that's a possibility.
Sure. And it's not like those, it's not like, so IPCC reports tell that we need urgent action. This is going to happen if we don't have urgent action, but they don't tell the ways that the urgent action, you know, and that's not the role of scientists anyway, to prescribe politics for us, you know. Then actually how it's implemented, kind of, as you said, you know, then it's like, then, you know, it's a different thing having the truth of an effect, you know, like the effect of climate change happening, you know, and the science of that. And then it's a different thing, like, well, okay, that, you know, there's different, many good ways where how we could like mitigate climate change, for example, or adapt to it. But then you need the kind of messy politics in that, right? And then comes like different kinds of opinions, viewpoints, and they can all be like right, but there's certain limits to that also. Like if somebody just says let's not do anything or let's not do enough, then you're still like ignoring the scientific reality of what's happening to our planet, right? So you know, there it's kind of it's more like it gives a certain framework, but then like how you actually implement it, and then what you, so that is denial, is like ignoring the science, ignoring the reality, but it doesn't give you like this blueprint of action. And I think that would be very dangerous way as well. Then you would be also mixing the roles of like of politics and science, you know. I don't think that would be ideal.
Today. We really appreciate it. For more information, please visit our website and follow us on social media. All of this information is available in the description of this podcast. Once again, thank you. Until next time.